If you found this podcast, chances are you're a high achiever and you're successful. But now you're stuck and stressed, and you realize that everything you've created hasn't given you the fulfillment and the joy you thought it would. This is where we discuss the keys of high performance mindset and stepping into the next best version of yourself. Welcome to the Positive Persistence Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Positive Persistence Podcast, where we bring you stories to inspire you and strategies to help you tap into your potential and become your best self. And we are joined by a special guest today, one that my wife and I have had the pleasure of knowing for a little over a year now, and we've become fast friends. Kim Wisek, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ian. I can't believe it's already been a year.
Yeah, I know.
It's a long time.
It's been quick. Yeah. Well, Kim, there's so much that I want to talk to you about, but I want to give our viewers and our listeners a little bit of a background about you before we get into our conversation. So Kim, she has been a leading global drug safety advocate and speaker for over 25 years. She has professional experience in advocacy, advertising, and marketing communications. And I want you guys to remember that about the advertising and marketing communications, because we're going to talk about that as well. But she is currently a very vocal consumer representative on the FDA advisory committee evaluating new drugs coming to market. Now, her work as an activist has led her to uncover the lack of transparency and information regarding the potential side effects of medications such as antidepressants. And her efforts were instrumental in getting the FDA to include black box warnings on antidepressants, highlighting the risk of increased suicidal thoughts and behaviors. Well, Kim, your journey and the action that you have taken personifies the phrase positive persistence. And you are such an incredible human, and you have done such amazing things. But I want to give our viewers and our listeners, I guess, a peek into why you have become so enrolled in drug safety advocacy. I was hoping you could share that with us.
Sure. Well, trust me, I would never have chose to do this, but sometimes our greatest purposes choose us. And that is one of the lessons I've learned. So I like to call myself an accidental advocate. Again, it started with a very personal story. I was married for 10 years, so my husband planning, I had all my life planned out exactly the way I was going to go, right? And my husband had just started an antidepressant with no history of depression. 5 weeks later, took his own life. And so, as you can imagine, my entire world blew up in, like, the Challenger into a zillion pieces. I didn't even know who I was. And when you have something like that happen to you, like, you kind of go into investigative mode on everything, right? But that night that Woody died, which, of course, intuitively inside me, I was like, what? There's no way Woody killed himself. Like, there's no way. Like, everything in my body was like, there's no way. Because he wasn't depressed. He had no history. He had just started his dream job. He got an antidepressant, which he knew. I don't even think we even knew that it was an antidepressant, but, you know, trusted the doctors. But that night that he was found, the coroner asked me one simple question. Was he on any medication? And the only medication he was taking was Zoloft. And so she proceeded to say, we're going to take the drug with us. It might have something to do with his death. And then also the front page of our paper that same day, which is so amazing, the signs, because Woody did not leave a note, and he left notes all the time. Like, we both traveled all the time for work. So I always call him the honey-do list. It was usually like, hey, can you do this? Can you pick this up? I love you. So there was no note, but in some ways, God left me notes. Like, these were the notes. The fact that that night coroner asked, and then the front page of our newspaper had an article that said, UK finds link between antidepressants and suicide. And so that really started this journey of, coupled with like everything inside going, there's what? Like, what? You know, and of course, my entire life fell apart. So you know, those first days, I was not going, oh, well, it must be the drug. You know, I mean, I wasn't doing that, but those were like seeds planted. I mean, truly, I was out of town when I got the call from my dad. And I look back to that night and I'm like, I was in the middle of a production and I saw myself outside my body observing this, what just happened. I remember walking, I was in shock. I walked back into the studio. I'm like, hey, to the guy, one of the guys I was working with. I'm like, can you bring me back to the hotel? And I wasn't even bawling yet. Like, I was like, what? And we get back to the hotel. And then in the car, I told him what had happened. But that, so of course, when I got back to the hotel, and I can kind of remember like faint, I mean, that really bad hotel light. And the funny thing is, and this is where I knew that I was going to probably be all right, or that I was completely crazy. So I had a box of hair color in my luggage because I knew that I wasn't going to be able to get to the hair salon before we had plans in the weekend when I got back. So I'm like, well, I better bring a box of hair color so I could color my hair, because I've been gray since I had gray since I've been early 20s. So that night, as my phone's ringing, that my friend Mike's in the room with me and I'm coloring my hair because something, maybe it was that one little bit of sense of like, I've got something in control. Like, this is one thing I can control, while everything around me was crazy. So anyways, that was like that first night. And then the next morning, I just remember walking through the airport of Detroit and I literally walked with a blanket over my head. My friend Mike brought me back to Minneapolis. I walked with a blanket over my head because I thought everybody could see that all of a sudden, like, oh my God, her husband died. Her husband killed himself. What? Like, that's not who, you know, like, so everything, and I didn't want anybody to see who I was. I wanted nobody to know who I was. I wanted nobody to see who under that blanket. But that was my way of protecting myself. And really, that journey to do the work that I've done really started. I didn't choose this. This isn't the path I chose, but I have come to, now it's been 20 some years, and I've come to realize, oh wait, sometimes some of the greatest purposes, they're inside, like they were given to us if you look for them. And that's really, you know, I can look back, it's a lot easier looking back than when you're in the middle of it. But there's so many lessons and things that I've learned about myself because I sat in it, and in it meaning the pain, the grief, etc.
Yeah. Kim, can you tell us what was the path that you were on before this tragedy happened?
Well, I was kind of on my
own. What were you doing?
I was like working in advertising. I was like always like out. I needed to be out. I was doing work with, you know, interestingly, I had started a nonprofit, help bring this organization to Minnesota called Free Arts. And it was working with kids abused, neglected, at risk, using the power of art and mentors. So that was like kind of my passion, because I love art, I love creativity, I love kids. And also like people, I've always kind of had a thing for like the voiceless. And like the ones who's sticking up for them, right? These kids that, you know, and it's funny when I look back. So that's kind of who I was. And I had, you know, I always had a little bit, I mean, I had faith. I mean, I grew up in a faith, you know, like church and whatever, but I don't think I didn't know what that really was all about until it became, you know, I would go to church and be like, have a relationship with God. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but I can tell you right now, because we did not have kids, we were planning on having kids. But when I came home, I remember that was kind of that burst. And it reminds me of a scene in Eat, Pray, Love, which is I love that movie, where it's like, hi, God, I think
with Julia Roberts.
Yeah, with Julia Roberts, when she was like wanting to leave her marriage. And I remember like going, all right, I guess it's you and me, God, because I had nobody to talk to. And then I realized that became this whole relationship. Because I had no one else to, I mean, it's just me. And then those are the times when you ultimately realize, like, it is you as the center and everything else is external. And I think I gave so much external that I never really was internal.
Wow. That's, I'm still just, you know, I've known that this story obviously for quite some time before we had this conversation, and still, I just can't imagine. I can't imagine. I was hoping you could walk us through like some of your initial coping mechanisms and how you found the strength to channel your grief into what is now your advocacy work. Like, I mean, how do you bounce forward from something like that?
I didn't choose to do this. I think when you're in it, in the middle of it, you're just kind of one moment, like not even one day, it's like 1 minute at a time and being super present. Like I was surrounded by people, like my friends, because, you know, I was young and nobody could even relate to it. My family was there. Nobody wanted me to stay alone. But I realized the very first night when I got back the next day after Woody died, my house was lined up with people and like almost to the point it was too much. But my sister came to me and she goes, I have a friend whose friend's like multiple levels back, husband died the same way 10 years earlier. I'm like, oh, can I talk to her? Like immediately my body was like, can I talk to her? And it was like that right there, another sign of like, I just wanted to talk to somebody who had been through something. And all, like, she was the only one I wanted to talk to. And I remember that evening sitting, my sister got her on the floor. I sat on the phone and I kept saying, am I going to be okay? Am I going to, like, am I going to be able to breathe? Am I going to laugh again? Please, please tell me this is not going to be me. Please, please. Like, I was holding on to every bit. So hope, that idea of finding that little bit of hope, because she became, I met her eventually, but those words, like, promise me, I'm 10 years out. I love again. I laugh again. Life is fuller than it's ever been. And so I held on to that going, well, she said, you know, like if she said, you know, like that was, so I think that idea of finding a bit of hope, then I think just my prayer, like I started, I mean, obviously, prayers were really, really, really important. And I also think there was a part of me when I got home, because all of a sudden Woody's dead, right? And my house is empty. And this idea of you come in the world with nothing, you leave with nothing. Like, he didn't take anything with him. Like, all the things that we strive for in life, having like a, you know, great house, all the money, like the clothes, he had a great set of clothes. Like, he took nothing with him. It was like all of a sudden he was there and then gone, right? So that idea of sitting in this empty space and praying, like I was like, God, use my pain, like, and praying and trying to understand, like, this life is just gone. So I was like asking so many questions. And I remember because he was gone, I needed to physically see him, because when I left for out of town, like we were already planning our, you know, we had just booked all these trips. So I remember, and again, I have no idea where this was, but Woody always said, throw my ashes in the middle of the lake. And I'm like, no, I need to see you. So I had the funeral home actually open up the box. And I'm telling you, it was like NCIS or one of those like crime shows where they pull out this body on a gurney. And I had to like, I needed to physically see it. And so there was something about this idea of planting that seed of accepting what is, because otherwise it could have been, because everything in my house was the same, looked the same. It looked no different than if he was out of town on work. Like he was gone on a, you know, right before he died, I was on a 3-week shoot down in New Zealand. So it could have been like the opposite where he was out of town on a big, you know, job or something. So I needed to go see him. So I literally, they pulled him out. I laid on the gurney with him and I had to feel him. And like, so there was something that was planting then too of this concept of, which I now call it like kind of face it. You got to own it. Like you have to, like healing begins when you accept what is and not fight reality or like the illusion and creating. Like, you know, I'm not saying it, that happened right away, but that kind of planted the seed almost 2 days later, again, a seed. So I learned that there's a lot of seeds being planted that I didn't know how they would all connect at some point or what would grow from them. But I think I needed to see and sit in that.
Wow. I mean, that is an extreme version of acceptance. as you had mentioned. And wow, that's incredible. And then
I don't know where that came from. I honestly, you know, yeah. I think like in some ways, maybe God gives us this this ability. I don't know. Like, I really don't know where that comes from. You know what I mean? Like, I did not think that I would ever have that in me to do something like that, you know, but I needed to see him. I needed to see that my life as it was or something. I don't know. Like, at the time, I don't think it was conscious, but maybe these are the things when I realized we have it, like God's part of this whole thing, like, or the way we're designed, that, you know, these, or maybe all of my, you know, I remember going to grief counseling after, because I did try to go to suicide group, right? Because the funeral home said, oh, well, you might want to go to a suicide support group. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know what else, like, what else do you do when this happens, right? So I went once, and literally I was watching all these people, and no offense, because it's a horrible thing, but I don't know that I ever identified myself as a suicide supporter from the beginning. And meaning that I was watching this room, people who had been there 10, 15 years. And I was like, that is not my life. Like, I can't have, like, just like, no, that doesn't feel right. That can't be what. And I remember saying, like, to the group, I said, well, I think my husband with the medication. And they literally patted me on the head and they're like, oh, honey, we never saw it coming either. And I'm like, and I could feel myself inside getting super mad. And I remember my friend who was staying with me at that time came to my house and said, she goes, why are you going? Why are you going to that if it doesn't make you feel good? And I'm like, well, aren't I supposed to do this? And she goes, well, no, why? So I started going to a faith grief group at church called Grief Share. It was amazing. But that was another insight of listening to ourselves. Because I don't think our bodies lie to us when something doesn't feel right. There's because our little spirit that's like a little light inside, even if it's still burning bright, who this is all circumstances. And that little light was like, no, this is not for you. Like, and the same thing with, you know, when the doctors wanted to give me a pill and said, do you think you want something? I'm like, no, but I think it's what killed my husband. But aren't I supposed to hurt? Like, my husband died. And the doctor's like, well, you don't need to. And so I think there's this idea of this light inside us, even though everything around us is dark. I think that little light is still inside. You know, I think that little light is our soul that knows that is. And I've come to believe that we're human. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. And if we remember that, which is just a perspective, then yeah, that little light, even though it was really buried and probably buried for a long time, it, you know, became brighter and brighter as, you know, you kind of explore and find your own self, I guess that's what they call it. But because I remember going to, when I started going to grief counseling, and she would ask me, you know, it started out with Woody, because I didn't know how to, like, Woody did everything for me. Like, he allowed me to go live the life I lived, meaning he would go shopping all the time. Like, you know, he'd be like, hey, I'm going to Target. What do you need? So I didn't even have to like go to Target. Like, he did all of it for me so that I could, because he let me be a butterfly and fly, right? And so I had to learn how to do all of that. And I remember all of a sudden we start getting into, she started asking me some questions. And I go, wait a minute, why are we asking about me? Like, why are we asking about my childhood? Why? I thought we were talking about the grief around Woody. And she goes, well, yeah, but like everything comes back to you and how you were like raised and like what was your experiences? Let's kind of go through some of those things that you maybe haven't dealt with from your childhood. And I was like, wait a minute. I felt like the tables got turned thinking, now why are you getting inside me? But anyways, so that was also something, because I think I ran from that and getting to know who that person was. And so I was able to again, the grief, and was giving it all outside to Woody versus she was trying to bring it back and for me to look inside at me.
Right. Because that will determine how you respond to the situation, right? And man, okay. Mm-hmm. That's a whole nother conversation we could have But coming back to this, so here you are. I mean, you're going through all this grief and you're trying to figure it out and figure out what to do with life, and everything's, I would imagine, spinning like crazy. Was there a particular moment or an experience that really like solidified your resolve to then eventually pursue these changes that you've been able to create in drug safety regulations? Like, where was there a certain point to where dealing with everything that you were dealing with that you decided to turn your focus or put your energy into the avenue that you pursue now?
Yeah, I would say, again, like I said, I don't know that I intentionally chose this, right? But I do remember a prayer, like right after, like maybe a couple days after Woody's funeral, because we did end up having like this beautiful service where his body wasn't shown, but I did make everybody see it the night before, again, because I needed everybody to know he's gone for me. But anyways, after I came home, and my agency that I worked at made all these Lifetime posters of Woody, and they were like lined up in my basement. And I remember looking at him and crying because I felt like he was real, like sitting on the floor with me. But I just kept grabbing, like literally scratching my heart, like, take my pain and use it. It does me no good, God. I'm over and over. Because for people who've had grief, any kind of, like, I never knew that heartache was real until that, like really real. Like, it's a pain. And I was trying to, like, I literally had scratch marks on it. But that prayer, I think, planted something. And meanwhile, I didn't know my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, was doing all this research on like all this stuff. And he didn't sleep the first week after Woody died. And he's doing his whole journey of like, this doesn't even make sense. Like, what if it's something to do? And so I think those two were kind of like the planting again, planting seeds. And so remember, this is 2003. There were no warnings. Everybody's thinking Woody was depressed. I didn't see it, right? And so when we were getting ready, because Woody always said, throw my ashes in the middle of Lake Michigan. So we did something in Minneapolis, and then we did his ashes. And my brother-in-law and I were sitting at the edge of a boat in out in the middle of Lake Michigan. And I was holding this box of ashes of Woody. And my brother-in-law standing, and I'm like, I cannot believe this is what we become. It's like ashes. And we already had started, like, we're going to go to DC. I think this is it. Like, everybody's saying no, whatever. But literally, I kid you not, in the middle of the lake, right in front of us, is this book that goes like this, floating by, and it's red. And I go, Eric, does that say what I think it does? And he's like, yeah, it says what I think it, and it said in, it was a red book, and it was literally open like this, so you could see the cover. It said the Holy Bible in gold letters. It's like, if I was the only one that saw it, people would think I was like a crazy widow losing her mind. But the two of us saw it, and it was almost as if it was a sign. Well, it was a sign, massive sign, because books don't float. Because trust me, I went back to when we got back in the on the port. I said, hey, I have a question, because it was the Chicago Search and Rescue boat that took us out. I go, have you ever gotten a Bible out of the water? And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he goes, ma'am, I've been doing this work for 25 years. I've never found a book because book or a Bible because books don't float. And I kind of knew that answer because they sink. You know, they don't. That was like a massive, like, boom sign. So really, I think that was like God giving me a nod, like, you guys are on the right path. Trust me, this is huge. I'm going to be surrounding you with like light and strength. And don't worry about Woody. He's up here. Like, so I think there were so many messages. But now I tell that story because I don't think that floating Bible is for me. Like, I think that Bible story is now for everybody. Like, it's part because I think there are a lot of people who don't think maybe there's real or no one cares about me or whatever, but like, oh, no, there's something real. I don't know what it is. I have no idea, but I guess that's kind of where it really cemented this idea of faith. And faith is just a belief that in something you can't see, right? But so is fear. So you get to choose. And so I, and for me, because we, like, I just felt like, again, landing intuitively going, there's no way Woody killed himself. Like something had to have been a part of this because he loved life and it would never do this to me or, you know, to his family. And so that became my sign every time we'd get on a plane and I'd look down. I mean, we were down there out there 40 times because I'm like, oh, no. And maybe there was part of me because what I always said, I never judge my life by how much money I make or my career. It'll be based on my family, my friends, and leaving the world a better place. So I kind of felt like, no way, Woody, like suicide's not going to be your legacy. Like we're going to make sure that there's something, you know, we're going to do something with this. Because when we learned that in 91, the FDA had hearings when it was just on the emergence of violence and suicide with Prozac, 91. I mean, I was like in college, like 91. That wasn't even on my radar. I knew nothing about it. It's now 2003 and all those years. And now we have Zoloft that came on the market and Paxil that came on the market and approved for kids. I'm like, oh, no. Like if we didn't know and we're smart, like they didn't get their job done in 91. Well, that's because half those committee, almost all those committees members took money from pharmaceutical companies that made antidepressant products. So that became like kind of our mission to go get warnings. And so I think that resolve, there was like a resolve. And also knowing there is something about like that helped my grief when you have like a purpose or you find something. And I remember learning that in our grief share at church. They tell you when you are going through grief of any type, and that could be a breakup, that could be losing, when you go out and volunteer or you go and like turn it away from and serve and not sit and stew, like, because you just go like, I mean, trust me, I can spiral. That I think there was a part of this that was huge in my grief process. And I think my why was so much bigger. And then I had to keep going back to that Bible. So I was like, connecting all these dots, even when I got scared, because trust me, that was not me at all. Like I never stirred the pot ever. I was like probably more of a people pleaser, the good girl. Like I literally, my mom recently gave me all my report cards and I was reading them. I'm like, seriously? Like, was I really this? Like, I felt like just this little like, and I was that person. I was afraid to use my voice. I was always like, she never causes any problems. She just sits there out. I'm like, oh God, how boring. But anyways, that's who I was.
It's time to ask yourself, when was the last time you prioritized you? Did you know that research shows that nearly 85% of high performers struggle to maintain a performance mindset while juggling the demands of work and personal life? Those who actively prioritize their performance mindset and personal growth are 30% more likely to achieve their goals in business and life. If you're feeling crippling stress and anxiety, or if you're feeling guilty when you take a moment for yourself, or if you're stuck in the grind and feeling burnt out, you're not alone. Many of us yearn for more, but struggle with the fear of being judged or feeling selfish, and you want to step into the next best version of yourself. That's why I created the Rinse Method, which got me from paraplegic to marathon runner. Backed by science-based proven strategies and now customized for high performers like you. If you're stuck and stressed and want clear steps that you can implement today to move forward, make sure you visit thepositivepersistence.com to download our free Rinse PDF.
I mean, that makes your story so much more incredible because, I mean, you chose to stand up to Big Pharma and the FDA machine, and you demanded honesty, you demanded transparency, you demanded reform, accountability. I mean, you were basically like uncovering corruption, and I can't imagine, like, what was that like? I mean, here you are, just one person, and you're taking on this huge mechanism that is Big Pharma and FDA, which is basically in bed together, and yeah. You're standing up and saying and pointing the finger and calling them out.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So back then, I had no idea that you would meet. I met so many other families out when I started going to DC, because part of it back then, we didn't have social media. So you actually, if you wanted to get involved, you had to show up. Like magic happens when you show up. And so when you show up, you start meeting other people. And in this process, I met families after families after families who came to the FDA to give their 3 minutes. And a lot of them, that's what they did, but they used their story to help. But they were like little 12-year-olds who got Zoloft for test anxiety and hung herself. Like it was, and all of these people, like it was not about having like depression, et cetera. Like these were all like breakups. They killed themselves. Another one graduated from college, stabbed herself with like outside her parents' door. Like these are families. And when you just get that, like it like hit me of these are like innocent, like little kids. I'm like, this is happening to little kids and that are like 12. You don't, like, how does a 12-year-old even know how to do that? Right. So you use all of that. And I also saw during that time, and I think this is where, you know, I never thought my voice mattered, right? Because I remember Woody, like, tried to get me involved because they were putting 2 cell phone towers in our neighborhood, like, on the corners, 2 competing cell phone towers. And so he was like, let's go get petitions, get people to sign off on them, and I'll bring them to city council and I'll present them because they, you know, they can share one. And I was like, you'll never, Woody, you'll never make a difference. Like, what you're going to, and you're going to like, and you wanted me to help. And I'm like, no, thanks. You can have it. And he goes, I remember I'd rather try like hell and lose than do nothing at all. And I'm like, have fun. And then fast forward, I'm like, wait a minute, dude, you left me with this. And I'm like, but I think it was this idea that one person, just that resolve and like that, your why is so much bigger than anything else. And when I would see these families, like my take, and there were, trust me, these hearings back in the day, I mean, trust, my voice shook. I would write, I had 3 minutes to give to a talk or 3 minutes to tell our story at the FDA, same with everybody else and experts. And I was out with my brother-in-law. I mean, we always would share rooms, and I'd be staying up till like 4 a.m. rewriting my talk for 3 minutes, and I'd be changing words, and because I was so nervous, and he would be like, oh my God, stop, like go to bed, like you're only changing and then, you know, like these ridiculous words. But anyways, these hearings were lined up with armed guards and media. I mean, literally, you've never seen anything. There were like hundreds of people that would be coming out. Half the room was like, these drugs saved our lives. And the other half's like, you killed our kids. You have blood on your hands, angry. And I'm just sitting there going, this doesn't, and I feel like this is where my kind of advertising background or, you know, understanding how to get something like all of a sudden kind of kicked in because yeah, it wasn't this blaming. It was like, wait, why won't you just give us the information? Like this to me is why wouldn't you warn? Like you guys knew about this in 91. Why didn't you put warnings on? This is not about taking anybody's drugs off the market. This is not about saying they killed. Like everybody has that. But when we don't have all the information, we're the ones that lose. And so why wouldn't you give us all information and let us make the informed decision and the right decision? So when Woody was telling me his head's outside his body the week before he died, and I'm like, I had never seen that before, and he's bawling. I could have said, maybe it's the medication, but instead he's going, I don't know, maybe. And I'm like, quit your job. Like, you know, there's all these things. We didn't have a chance because we didn't know all the information. And so I think that became, you know, I start looking back and go, oh, wait, this all makes sense in, you know, and but literally when you saw kids and these parents and the grief of others, it just, it brought me back to when I was working with those kids at Free Arts that I was telling you about, the abused, neglected, at risk. And I remember these kids that had been removed from the home, living in a foster big like system. And it was a locked ward. And the kids were, you know, of the, whatever you call them, residents of the state. Every one of those kids stopped in at night when we got to, and picked up a cup of meds. And I remember like, oh my God, are they all sick with, and this was in 97. I'm like, are they all sick? Like they had strep throat. And their staff person said, no, this is their behavior medicine. And I was like, So all of this stuff of my life started just kind of like flashing by me, like, wait, that never made sense then, but I didn't get involved. But I remember thinking, that's weird, behavior medicine. I've never even heard of behavior medicine. So that's kind of, I think all of that played a part. And also all I was doing, like, during this whole time, and I did have a lawsuit against Pfizer, I saw that if you are actually telling your truth and your story, like your truth, you don't have to, and you're not lying. It kind of goes back to one of those principles that your mom would tell you, you know, got to remember, if you lie, you have to remember to dot your I's and cross your T's. And I saw that in playing out in adult life with companies and corporations and the FDA, like, they had to remember, oh, wait, 91, we said this. Oh, wait, the documents that we got out from SEALs say this. And now you're saying this. Like, what is it? But it goes back to, like, you know, one of those small little things. So I think, yeah, I don't know how that all, like, answers your question, but I think there is something with right and wrong that you learned as a kid. And I think there's that great book, Everything We Learned in Kindergarten. And I feel like some of these basic principles I saw, but these are adults and big companies that don't even play by those rules.
And I think, you know, to go back to what you had mentioned earlier about being in marketing and advertising and understanding manipulation and persuasion, I just want to read a quote from you that says, to be clear, I am not anti-drug, I'm pro-information. A 25-year career in advertising and marketing has taught me all about the art of persuasion and even manipulation to get what you want. It's also shown me how to connect the dots, in this case between Washington, the FDA, Big Pharma, patient disease awareness organizations, and the healthcare system. And I think that is so interesting that, again, you had the seeds, as you've mentioned, of advocacy planted in you before Woody passed. And then having all that experience in marketing and advertising, understanding how to basically persuade someone to want your product, lends to you having a very keen understanding of how these drug companies were then advertising their products to seem harmless and to be like the magic bullet pill. Just take this and you'll be better. No side, and don't tell you about the side effects. And I just think that's amazing that you had all of this in you before this happened. And then, like, you were chosen. Like, you were the person that was supposed to do this. And just for people who don't understand, you sued Pfizer, who is the creator of Zoloft and many other products, and you won. And you won. And because of your work, now they have to tell people, give them the information. And when I first met you, I didn't know what black box warning was. You know, I've seen it obviously on things, but I didn't know, like, that was what it was called. And I didn't know that it wasn't always there. But because of you and your work, now it is. Mm-hmm. That's amazing to me that, again, your positive persistence through, I can't imagine the pushback and the hurdles and the adversity that you went through going, like you said, to DC dozens of times to get this to happen. And you, I mean, the proverbial pushing a rock up a hill, I mean, that had to have been, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I can only assume that had to have been your experience.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Many times I'd come home and I just want to bang my head on the wall because it's not, like, nothing's happening. And I'd be like, and it's such a big machine, and it doesn't move fast enough, and it's not quick enough, and it's not far enough, but just those little increment moves. Like, to this day, the antidepressant warnings only go to age 24, and it doesn't go all ages. All the documents we got out from under seal from Pfizer show that all ages are at risk. And so it never made sense that, you know, a 24-year-old, you got to be warned, but now you're 25 tomorrow and you don't. Like, that has never, common sense has never made, I thank my dad for common sense.
So for my understanding and all of our listeners and viewers, when you say under seal, that means that there are sealed documents, sealed information that these companies have that they're not making public.
Yes. And that is what, this is why the role of lawsuit is super, uber important. And mm-hmm. so like we have to be able to get in because the FDA doesn't have access to get into those drug companies. Congress can't get into those drug companies' files. The only way you can get in is you have to be able to have a lawsuit and you have, and it, they don't just open those up. So there's a lot of things that happen to try to get the lawsuits thrown out, dismissed. So you can't have discovery, but discovery is key. And one of the things that I learned also, this is fascinating, through my lawyers, I learned that one of the first places that they will go is the marketing department, not the science. It's the marketing department. I'm like, well, of course, that's what the whole business is built on, marketing and over promoting. And then what I learned again, who would have ever like thought, who wants to talk about like drug safety and like how the FDA works? But once I did, I'm like, people need to understand that the drug companies control the trials. They then present their data, their summaries to the FDA to get a drug on the market. Well, what company is really, like the whole idea, the system is to sell benefits. No one wants to talk about the harms, but the harms don't emerge until, because we're one of only two countries in the world that allow drug ads, period. So the real harms don't come on the market until it's being taken by millions of people, right? And then you start seeing somebody getting harmed. Well, that's when the lawsuits happen, right? And so then with like, so in my lawsuit, it, those documents were not discovered at my time, meaning they were from another lawsuit, but the judge, the federal judge in my case, released them and made them public. So I literally marched, my brother-in-law and I called him the binder boy. We marched because we would have like 30 binders and we would march them out to DC, give them to everybody. Because it was no longer, you don't want to believe, like, oh, literally the FDA told us when we went in to tell Woody's story with some other families, they said, oh, that's just, literally called us this. That's just an anecdote. That didn't, we didn't see it in the double-blinded placebo-controlled study. So I'm like, wait a minute, Woody is not an anecdote. He's a real person. So is my friend Matthew. So is my friend's son and daughter, Candace. These are real people. Are you kidding me? And so that's when I realized, oh, they control everything, the whole thing. But once you get into the files, the judge, and by the way, Pfizer argued for years that these were trade secrets. Like this was marketing. This was like going to keep their, you know, we don't want the competitor. And the judge in my case was like, these aren't marketing. These are not trade secret. He's like, so he released them and he actually like called them. Because at this time, Pfizer, when Woody was around, they were those white bouncing balls. And that was the advertising. Like, do you get nervous in a room? You might have social anxiety disorder and only your doctor can know. I'm like, oh my God, this is like this is like my business gone awry. Like, this is my average, like I've worked on a lot of brands. I've never worked on pharmaceuticals, because I'm looking at this going, this is not actually ethical. Like, why wouldn't you give people, the system is like this. The benefits really are down here and the harms are here. We need to level set and be truthful with people. And you could still make money. I'm all about making money, but not at the expense of people's lives. And that's why you have documents. But a lot of times these documents sit in the vaults of the drug companies or any kind of company and never see the day of light. This is why I always say the best, and I think it might have been JFK that said the best disinfectant to truth is sunlight. So you got to shine the light on, you know, on what's going on that's beneath the surface.
Yeah. And that is exactly what you did. And it's such an amazing David and Goliath story where you've taken the pharmaceutical company's industry to the mats and you've won. And you're putting that message out that is so important that, and it should be a no-brainer that you put people before profits, yeah. But that's not really the case. But I just want to bring attention to the strength that you have shown, the resiliency that you have shown, and the message that you're putting out there of what is possible. Taking away all of the situation that you're in and just really and just focusing on simply you digging in and finding your inner strength and the voice that you thought you didn't have and taking it to the courts in the capital of our nation and being heard and winning. So for our listeners and viewers, when you are up against it and you feel that you can't win, know that it is possible. I mean, Kim, you are such an amazing example of that. And the things that you have achieved and continue to achieve are nothing short of astonishing. And I applaud you. And I just think you're incredible.
Oh, thanks. Well, you know, I'm going to say to anybody who doesn't think their voice matters or that one person can't make a difference, I am literally living proof of it. Like, I didn't know what I was made up of until I had to go through the fire. And I don't know. And so I always say this, like through the worst experience of my life, losing Woody, I found my life. And so in a lot of ways, I have this like gratitude for the pain. You know, again, I probably would never, it would be really hard for me to find gratitude back then in the pain. But I look at it, and I'm like, whoa, thank you. Like, thank you, Woody. Like, thank you. Like, I would want him back. So I don't mean it like that. But like, I learned so much about myself and I never thought one person. So I can say, I understand. I'd rather try like hell and lose than do nothing at all. And I love that kind of spirit because one person and a small group, like I think there's that famous Margaret Mead quote about, never doubt a small group of committed citizens can make the change. Indeed, it's the only thing that's changed the world. And I'm paraphrasing it. But literally, when you are on purpose, have a belief. Like I had a unquestionable, undeniable, like I believed in every part of my body that this was the right thing. This is what happened. Like, so it was never even like a, like maybe it wasn't, like I just believed it. And I think there's some power in the belief that whatever you believe in or think you can do, and it starts local. And when I say local, you know, I went to DC because that's where it was. I did things local and you always hear like doing your backyard, doing that. But I even want to take a step further and go local actually starts with you. You taking a look at yourself and being and realizing and doing your own work that you might have to be willing to walk through some fire, be super uncomfortable, look in the mirror, do the same curiosity of questioning, like, what if all the stories I've told myself are wrong? What if I'm actually not that? What if? And it starts local, local, local with me. And then it can go wherever you're going to go, whatever it is, whatever you want to, you know, do. But I think it's, you can't go out and change something until like you start looking. And so I think this whole experience, I realized I was being changed on the inside on this like parallel path that I didn't realize when I was in it, but I could look that I was being kind of refined during that time, finding who I was worth. And God was changing me on the inside while I was doing something on the outside.
Yeah, I love that. That is so powerful, what you just said about starting local, because that's where the change needs to happen first. Absolutely. Kim, I want to wrap this up. I would love to talk to you all day about this, but I know that you are super busy. But I was hoping you'd give our viewers and our listeners ways that they could find out more about you and more about the advocacy that you do.
Sure. Well, I use for my advocacy platform, I'm on X and I do a lot of work on X. So you can find me at Woody Matters on X. I also, KimWitzak.com. I'm on Instagram and I'm going to try to share a little bit of my life, but some advocacy or things I've learned in my going forward on Instagram and Facebook. But that's under my name, Kim Witzak. And then I have a Substack called Acceptable Collateral Damage. And I can give you the links. And that's really where I write about different things. But I call it acceptable, but really, in parentheses, I put unacceptable, because people like you and I, everyday people, we should never be considered acceptable collateral damage or the cost of doing business. We are people, real lives, real, you know, and so that those are ways that you can find me. And at the end of the day, I'm going to say this is kind of like no one's going to ever care about you or your family's health and well-being more than you. The government's not, your doctors aren't. So really take curiosity, ask questions, don't be afraid. Because a lot of people I hear are like, well, I can never ask that to my doctor. You can challenge your doctor. Why not? Like, why not? And that is another way that I can say use your voice, because if it doesn't feel right intuitively and something that is happening, or you're asking questions about like, what's the data say, or you start, you know, and you're getting pushback, remember, no one's going to care more, because even that small percent, if they tell you, it's, oh, don't worry, it's a small percent. If that small percent becomes you or your kid or your husband or your parent, that's 100% of them. So you should care about what you put in, and don't be afraid to challenge.
That is awesome. That is definitely the correct message to put out there for sure. Kim, thank you so much. I appreciate you, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your journey and your advocacy. And we'll make sure to get all those links in the show notes so people can find out more about you and more about the work that you're doing. So once again, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks. I love what you guys do. And I appreciate you having and helping, because I call it the butterfly wings, the butterfly effect, right? You share it, yeah. share it, and eventually it spreads. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right, guys, that is another episode of the Positive Persistence Podcast. You guys know what we always say is that we need to stay positive, stay persistent, and remember, mindset is everything. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of the Positive Persistence family. We're having a great time creating this content, and we truly hope it inspires you to embrace positivity and persistence in your own journey. If this podcast episode inspired you or entertained you, scroll down, hit those stars, and leave a comment or two. Your 5-star reviews and shares encourage us and help us grow the show. So until next time, stay positive, stay persistent, and remember, mindset is everything.